CFUV 101.9 FM broadcasts from the Songhees and Wasanich territories, also known as Victoria, BC. You can listen to our music, spoken word, and multicultural programs anywhere, anytime at cfuv.ca.
Welcome to Guerrilla Radio, recorded October 30th, 2021. Well, next week, Canadians will again gather in towns and cities across the nation to commemorate Armistice Day, November 11th, 1918, and celebrate the fulfillment of the Great War's promise to be the war that ends all wars. But you needn't worry about putting to knee the youth of the land and painfully instructing them on the glorious horrors or forgotten methods and meanings of human warfare. The promise was a lie, and the wars and the lying about war persist a century and more later, obviously. Less obvious to even the most engaged citizen of this Canada, however, is the depth and breadth of the lies maintaining both the country's military and militarism in the country. The reasons for that dearth of Canadian incredulity are many, but primary among them is the dismal grasp of history here. Eve Engler is a Montreal-based political activist, essayist, lecturer, and author whose 11 books, mostly on Canadian foreign policy, are joined now by a 12th title, Stand on Guard for Whom? A People's History of the Canadian Military. Eve is preparing now for the far western swing of his book tour, which will see him presenting in Nanaimo, Victoria, Duncan, and Vancouver from November 10th through the 14th. Today, Eve Engler and revealing, remembering, and recognizing the pervasiveness of Canada's militarist past and present. Welcome back to the program, Eve.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, it's always my pleasure, and congratulations on the release of Stand on Guard for Whom. Can we start with the Canadian military's origin story?
Yeah, well, I mean, the Canadian military is really just the British military. That's the beginning, clearly. And that's, of course, a British military that dispossessed First Nations, Indigenous peoples here, and the Canadian military was even in the early points of the creation of Canada after Confederation, something like the Royal Military College in Kingston, Ontario, which was set up in 1876, was set up to train individuals in large part to be officers of British imperialism, and many Royal Military College trainees would go on to conquer different parts of West Africa, East Africa, fight in India, Afghanistan, elsewhere. And also, of course, they would be involved in, at the same time, some of them would be involved in the suppressing the Métis and Indigenous peoples in today's Manitoba, Saskatchewan, and so it's the naval base in Esquimalt was initially a British naval base, and it was just transferred over, and same thing goes for Halifax, and so from the get-go, the Canadian military has been really a tool of empire. And that is something that I think that, no one denies it. I mean, it's a simple historical fact, but it's sort of downplayed, the origins of the Canadian military and its ties to this British Empire that, conquered much of the world, employing all kinds of atrocities to do so. That's sort of downplayed in the popular discussion of the Canadian military.
Well, in the early days, I suppose it was deemed necessary to have the British military and then the successor Canadian version of it through and the RCMP to keep the Americans, especially here in Victoria. You mentioned Esquimalt Harbor. We sort of jut down south of the recognized border today. They were worried they made the capital here and the naval base here to protect against American expansionism. Is it legitimate to say that a Canadian military is necessary or was necessary in its inception to protect Canada from the Americans, essentially?
I mean, I think that the broader trajectory should be viewed as the force that conquered Turtle Island. And there was a time, there's no doubt, there was a time when the military planners saw the U.S. as a threat, and the U.S. did right until World War One had invasion plans of Canada that were elaborated, and so there was a nominal threat at that level. But I think that the more important understanding of the military's roots is as a tool of first of all, dispossessing Indigenous people and also participating in the British Empire. And, of course, the Canadians are sent to Sudan in 1884 to help the British maintain control of Khartoum. The Canadians that were sent to 7,000 Canadians sent to South Africa in 1899, early 1900s, to maintain British control over important transit corridor to India and also the mineral resources in South Africa, and then even in World War One. So the Canadian military, I mean, it's even in its defensive arrangements vis-a-vis a potential U.S. invasion, in the early 1900s or late 1800s. Its defensive arrangement included, of course, Britain coming to the aid of Canada in any sort of potential U.S. invasion. It included operations from the British colonies in the Caribbean, and so I think that the relationship with the U.S. was not as cordial as it is today, of course, but. I think that the framing the Canadian military as a primarily defensive entity has really never been true, and that goes right up until today, when it's very much a gone from an appendage of the British military empire to the U.S. Military empire.
Well, we're nothing if not adaptive. I was talking to a pretty smart guy recently, even. He said the difference between, as regards the relationships between the colonial powers and the indigenous population north and south of the border, the 49th year, was that in America it was an outright military genocide. In Canada, he put forward that Canada used the courts to dispossess more than they used the military. So I think even now there's this idea in Canada that the military and militarism and violence didn't play such a large role in the dispossession of Indigenous inhabitants across the country. Are we suffering again under a disillusion of what we're about and what our history spells out?
I would say yes to that. One of the elements I was very struck by in researching this book was the role of gunboat diplomacy in dispossessing Indigenous people in what is now British Columbia, up and down the coast, Haida Gwaii, and there was all these expeditions, these naval vessels that were sent usually from from the Victoria area upwards and north, and they all kinds of like threats to villages, and they would fire their cannons. I'm talking about right around the time of Confederation, the 1860s, 1850s, and they would fire their cannons just to send a message that if they don't follow orders, we can destroy all their huts and their community and kill people. And in many instances they did kill people. And then there was all kinds of raping going on. The justification was to uphold law, but then the naval vessels that were dispatched would of course engage in sexual assault and rape and stuff that everyone would consider counter to legal norms. So there's that history that the, you know, at this point the British mostly, but what became the, you know, Canadian naval force was engaged in, and this is all like the, this is coming from the words of the officials sending communiques back to London. So this is not, you know, coming from the indigenous perspective. This is coming from the you know, the sort of somewhat honest responses within officialdom. And then if you look at, you know, what happened on the East Coast, what took place with regards to the Mi'kmaq, putting people's heads on stakes and bounties for people's heads, and then where I wrote this book in part was on Amherst Street, who was of course a British general that engaged in biological warfare to exterminate indigenous people. Then if you look at some of what took place on the prairies, there's a level of brutality that is not did it reach in every instance the brutality of all elements of how the U.S. exterminated indigenous people. I mean, there's differences within there, of course, but to in any way try to act like the dispossession of indigenous people here wasn't a brutal, violent affair is really it's just not based in a historic fact, and that's to a large extent that's the roots of the Canadian military, and it's an element that when we talk about reconciliation today, it's definitely an element that deserves a lot more attention.
Well, and so does the fact of Indigenous resistance. We hear so little about it here. It's almost as if there wasn't any at all. And I guess that's a convenient way for us to downplay the brutality that you outlined, that they just sort of recognized our superiority, our settler superiority, and walked off to the reservation. And that was all there was to it.
The gunboat diplomacy up and down the in British Columbia, it was very clear that it was done to crush resistance. It was done because there was a rejection of British rule, and it was the same thing goes with the suppression of the Riel rebellions in the prairies. And also, if you look at the imposition of the pass systems on reserves that flows out of the second repression of the second Riel rebellion, the Métis and on the prairies, that the pass system is really, it's a form of control. Controlling people's ability to go on and off the reserve out of fear that there was, resistance, and out of fear that there was opposition to a Canadian or Anglo-Canadian, if you like, Euro-Canadian domination. So that history is ignored, and right up until today. Another element of the Canadian military, of course, dispatched to the so-called Oka crisis, but also if you look at the Canadian military has engaged in spying on Idle No More protests, engaged in plans to and has had identified their counterinsurgency manual in 2007, I believe it was, mentions the Mohawk Warrior Society as a threat. They ultimately withdrew that because there was a pushback to that being them mentioning the Mohawk Warrior Society. But there's still clearly this ethos within the military of seeing Indigenous resistance as a threat to the Canadian colonial system. So it's not something that there clearly was resistance. There clearly still is resistance, and the Canadian military has been involved in repressing that resistance and continues to to see indigenous resistance as a threat to the colonial system.
Well, if you just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Yves Angler. Yves, a Montreal-based political activist, essayist, lecturer. He's also an author. His 11 books are mostly on Canadian foreign policy, and his 12th one definitely is. It's Stand on Guard for Whom? A People's History of the Canadian Military. When you talk about Yves Oka, out here in British Columbia, there's Gustison Lake and what's going on even just up the street from me right now at Ferry Creek, where we have not the Canadian military, but the RCMP looking an awful lot like the Canadian military. Why would the Americans want the RCMP to be called the RCMP and not the Royal Canadian Military Police or whatever it was before that?
Because part of what you're saying, it was because it was right on, there was going to be a new force that was going to be on the U.S. border, right? On the in Manitoba border, that was going to be newly established, and that soften having policing in the name versus military in the name sort of had the perception that it was a little bit less of a potential challenge or a threat to U.S. The U.S. position in the, you know, the, I guess the west of the U.S.
So they were afraid that they would be annexed by Canada or its British masters.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how far that exactly went along, but yes, that was the kind of, it was things were substantially more fluid at that point, and so the Canadian officials thought that it would be a better marketing to not have military, because that could lead to more of the U.S. viewing it as more of a threat to their position in the region.
Let alone that all the towns out here were Fort something, this, that, or the other. Well, the Americans have the, however weakened today, the Posse Comitatus Act that says that the U.S. military can't be used against domestic enemies of the state or perceived enemies. What about Canada and the military function within the borders of this country? Is there any equivalent to the American Posse Comitatus Act here?
I'm not sure if there's an equivalent to the U.S. Act. One thing that I can say that was really also quite illuminating in researching the book is the role of the militia in suppressing strikes. So on one hand, the Canadian military begins as a tool to dispossess Indigenous people, but the other part of what the military is that between 1867 and 1933, the militia is called out to suppress about 70 different strikes, basically entirely on behalf of the employer. I mean, it's all, of course, framed as, you know, rule of law and whatnot, but it was almost entirely to undermine workers trying to get, you know, union recognition, trying to get, you know, a 9-hour or 10-hour workday, improved safety conditions, and so the militia is quite reviled by working class organizations at the time. There's all kinds of statements that are put out by unions and other working class associations, trying to actually even say that their members can't join the militia, and it's, you know, very much a middle class institution. And in many instances, it's actually the employers that pay for the militia, because in some cases they get it put up for like 6 months in the more extreme strikes or the more long lasting conflicts. They get put up for multiple months by the employer. So the militia was, and then after the Winnipeg General Strike, they boost the size of the militia because, again, there's sort of a view that there's a threat. There's an upsurge of union and working class kind of conflict, struggle, and so they boost the size of the militia. So the other part, the roots of the military, and the militia is very much run by wealthy people and people of at least middle class, status at the time. And so the military has this whole roots of being basically a tool to repress. After there's some changes to the legislation in the early 1930s, and that lessens. There's still a few more times over coming decades where the military is sent out to suppress strikes, but it greatly diminishes. But that's another part of the roots of the Canadian military is very much as a class institution to enforce the dictates of capital against labor.
Well, that reminds of the British system, the third son of the landed gentry being bought a commission and this, that, or the other, you know, to go off and enforce the empire and run the colonies, etc. I mean, this colonial mindset, it seems pervasive. Is that entirely adopted from our British predecessors?
It flows out. It's not quite as extreme. The militia and the whole, like, just purchasing of commissions and that existed for a couple centuries in Britain. It's not quite as extreme as the British system, but I mean, some of that actually does manifest itself in Canada, of course, because it's you know, the British military. So many of them are people who, you know, purchase those positions and whatnot. But that same process continues. And if you look at the ways in which the military has like honorary colonels and honorary generals and these, it's very much leading capitalists. And that's been the case for, you know, that's back to the time of the, you know, the post Confederation and the militia. But that goes up right until today. And if you look, you'll find people like Jeff Molson, the owner of the Montreal Canadiens, obviously Molson Brewery, people like the Desmarais family, Fred Mannix, the billionaire out in Calgary, and a whole bunch of others that are the Bata, who are you know, hundreds of millionaires or billionaires, who are these honorary positions within the military, and you find that so there's lots of leading capitalists, many sort of maybe call them mid-tier capitalists, and I actually didn't find one single like representative of a labor union. There's, you know, you find a few examples where there's like some you know, a journalist or some kind of academic or something like that, but heavily oriented towards the captains of industry, and almost no—I didn't actually find any. There may be somewhere. No examples of you know, a labor official or what we would call like sort of a representative of the working class. So the military still has, I mean, I think it's, you know, it's more formalized today than it was 100 years ago with the quite explicit wealth, you know, leading to positions within the militia. But it's still very much a class institution. And one of the ways that also manifests itself is that there's a, you know, sort of a revolving door between what's sometimes called rented general, where the top military officials, after they leave, after they retire from the military, they get plum jobs working for usually military suppliers, also for sort of lobbying firms that lobby around military procurement. So there's still a way, you know, still sort of at least the top end of the military very much gets paid after retiring from the military, gets paid salaries that are you know, quite large salaries for I would presume most of the time fairly little work. And that also contributes to maintaining the military as very much a corporate class kind of institution.
Well, again, if you just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking to Eve Angler. We're talking about his just published book, Stand on Guard, For Whom? A People's History of the Canadian Military, We're going to take a brief break here, but we will be back in just a minute to pick up again with Eve Angler, so stick around.
When nothing is as it's presented.
It's a bit like discovering that your favorite uncle has taken you for walks in the park, but that he's really a serial abuser.
You need a different source. Guerrilla Radio on CFUV 101.9 FM and CFUV.ca. A century of news every Thursday and Saturday.
So, Eve, when you talk, that we used to be a country that was referred to ourselves famously as a country of two solitudes. What about the dynamic of Quebec and all this? This is such, the military has such a heavily British influenced provenance. What about the you're in Montreal? What about that schism between the two solitudes of Canada? Where does Quebec figure in the military picture of Canada in its formation and in its present incarnation?
The British conquered defeated the French, and that, you know, many Quebecois view themselves as being, you know, conquered militarily. There's obviously a whole history of the, you know, resistance to Canadian militarism being basically overwhelmingly led by Quebecois. So, First World War, there was substantive opposition to the war here in Quebec. The militia kills in a battle in just after there was a forcing people. I'm totally blanking on the word here.
Conscription.
Conscription, exactly. When conscription was adopted, multiple people killed in Quebec City who it began over a dispute over whether the person had the proper papers to saying didn't have to join the military. I live next to a hockey rink called Camille Houde, who was the mayor of Montreal, who was thrown in jail during World War II because he was basically warning about the possibility of conscription. So there is this history. There's also, I mean, even more recent, I think in 2003, the reason why the Canadian government didn't officially join the Bush administration's Coalition of the Willing was because of the protests in Montreal, in Quebec in general, but primarily in Montreal, which were by far the biggest demonstrations. So there is this this pacifist streak, which has an element of it that certainly the historic element is that, you know, we don't see ourselves, Quebecers don't see themselves as part of the, you know, Anglosphere, if you want to call it that, and therefore why should we send troops to South Africa in the late 1800s, to World War One, to World War Two, etc. You know, so that is a history that you know still there. Now at the same time, I think that, you know, the military has you know, Quebec is still, you know, there's a big portion of the military are Quebecers, and, you know, here in Montreal, you see, you know, I see young people in uniform quite a bit. So I think that my sense is that, unfortunately, I would say that I get the impression that Quebec is moving a little bit away from its pacifist kind of history, and that the sort of there's an element of a rise of Islamophobia and sort of right wing nationalism that I think that plays itself out, you know, leads itself towards being supportive of war, and I think you see that with like Gilles Duceppe, the head of the Bloc Québécois, who was calling for Canada to join in the he was really supportive of bombing Syria and Iraq in 2014 and other sort of missions, wanted Canada to sort of really join alongside the U.S., which is quite a turnaround, because again, back in, you know, in the lead up to the 2003 Iraq War, the Bloc Québécois and the Parti Québécois, and ultimately even Jean Charest, the Liberal Premier of Quebec, they were very much questioning Canada joining that conflict. So I think it also should be pointed out that, you know, a huge chunk of the arms industry is here in Montreal, right? The whole aerospace, Canada's biggest arms company, you know, Canadian-based head office company, is a CAE, which trains pilots, drone training, etc. And it, you know, in the book I quote CAE officials, you know, talking about how this, you know, increase in the U.S. military spending is a real boon to them. They have, you know, they're involved in so much training of U.S. Air Force, and so there is a big arms industry here in Quebec as well that you know plays some role in shaping opinion and obviously has a certain amount of political influence. But I would still say I think that, you know, if there is going to be you know, revitalization of anti-war movements, I think that Quebec would have to be would very much likely be at the center of any big, you know, anti-war kind of peace victories in this country.
Well, and I've got to admit my own ignorance. I come from an Anglo-centric point of view, way out here in the coast and in my education and that. So when I talk about Canadians being so woefully ignorant of their own history, I'm speaking generally of English Canada. Is it as common in French Canada that they view the military in the kind of glorious terms as they do in the Anglosphere, at the blue helmets and the force for good in the world and so on?
Oh, I think there's a certain level of popular consciousness around like World War One and Quebec's, I mean, you know, there were tanks called out to the street, to, you know, St. Catherine Street, the most important street in Montreal during the 1970 October crisis. I think that is something that's not that's known. So is the opposition to conscription during World War One. That's known. Again, like I said, it was the mayor of Montreal that was thrown in jail for multiple years during World War Two. There's definitely a much higher level of understanding that the military is not just a, benevolent force. And I think that translates into a greater ambivalence towards, the idea of Canada's role in UN peacekeeping this just general view of the military as benevolent, that I think is stronger. And it varies in different communities. I think that there are military communities, obviously the naval base in Esquimalt, I think, has an impact on the political culture of the broader Victoria area in terms of its association with the military, and same thing with regards to Halifax, and obviously in other communities that are more tied into the military, that has an impact on the consciousness of the political culture. But there is no doubt that as a broad rule, Quebecers would be the most ambivalent towards the Canadian military.
Well, and that incredulity has a huge effect on the course of politics for the whole country, as you mentioned with Jean Chrétien, because in part, at least because of that skepticism in Quebec, that he refused to go along with the Coalition of the Willing and commit Canadian forces to bombing Iraq. But he did do a lot anyway, though, and he was credited by the Americans as actually, and Canada, as actually being a greater contributor than many of the countries that were in the coalition for the services that they provided outside of the limelight in supporting that war. So what about Jean Chrétien and this other use of not only the Canadian military, but Canada's cachet to support militarism?
Yeah, I think that's the 2003 Coalition of the Willing Iraq war is a best example of the fact that the Canadian military is so integrated with the U.S. military that it's almost impossible, probably too strong a word, but it's highly implausible that the U.S. military is going to engage in a major conflict without Canadian military support. And so what Chrétien did essentially was he denied the Bush administration what they wanted above all else, which was official endorsement of the Coalition of the Willing. But then he provided all kinds of military support to the U.S., the sort of more lower key, less high profile support. So he gives the sort of anti-war mobilization a big bone, but then continues to provide all kinds of support. And those different forms of support, were everything from, there were Canadians who were integrated into U.S. units. They kept fighting. They were stayed in their U.S. units, didn't return home when they got dispatched to Iraq. To a Canadian general who was in charge of, I believe, it was 35,000 troops in Iraq, because Canadian generals are regularly overseeing U.S. units as part of exchange programs. To the naval vessel, had Canadian naval vessels that were patrolling in the region that the Chrétien government actually had a legal opinion that it was legally at war with Iraq because of its role in intercepting and basically a blockade against Iraq in the lead up to the U.S. invasion. So I've joked previously that even if the U.S. was to invade Canada, that there would be Canadian military that would be involved in supporting that invasion, right? Because they're you go to the different American command structures, the NORAD, you got the whenever the U.S. is bombing anywhere, there are Canadians within the U.S. Military structure supporting that. So that is I think, something we need to understand, and we should lessen, right? There's hundreds, I think it's a 350 or so accords between the U.S. and Canadian government and or U.S. and Canadian militaries around military affairs. The best known ones are things like of course, NORAD. And these are things that there have been periods of time where anti-war and peace movements really, you know, had these issues high on the agenda. Canada out of NORAD or disband NORAD. Things like the defense production sharing arrangement, which allows, you know, Canadian military firms to sell, basically turns the North America into a, or Canada and U.S. into a joint arms industrial base where the sort of the border doesn't apply in terms of arms sales. So these are things that I think that we need to be bringing back up, and we need to be questioning all these relationships, because the U.S. military is a, there is no, you can't argue that the U.S. military is a defensive institution. It is a imperial institution, probably the greatest military force in terms of dominating the world that, you know, humanity has ever seen. And the Canadian military is basically seen by Washington, basically correctly, as just an add-on, right? So the biggest, one of the biggest forces pushing for increased military spending in this country is the U.S. government and the U.S. military. If the Canadian military was in any way oriented towards defense of Canada, the only country that has a plausible plausible that they would invade Canada, which is the U.S., the U.S. military wouldn't be pushing for increased Canadian military spending. The U.S. military understands correctly that the increased Canadian military spending, such as the plan to spend $19 billion on new fighter jets, which would be about $77 billion over the life cycle, or plan to spend $82 billion on 15 new naval vessels, which is something in the range of $280 billion over its life cycle, that is about enhancing the Canadian military's ability to participate in U.S. and NATO-led wars, acts of aggression. So that's really what the Canadian military is the 2003 Iraq War demonstrates, just the depth of the integration between the Canadian and U.S. militaries. And even when the political leaders don't give the official thumbs up to joining a U.S. operation, that effectively the Canadian military is going to be providing support to that mission. And that's something that we really need to start discussing, and we need to lessen, if not end.
Well, it's just interoperability. I thought that if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today to Eve Angler. We're talking about his book, Stand on Guard for Whom? A People's History of the Canadian Military. I saw you in a terrific online interview from a couple of weeks ago with a friend of the show, David Swanson, over at World Radio. And you mentioned something during the course of that interview about the role of Canada militarily in the modern context, going along with the United States as it once did with Britain in the Korean War, and how from that moment on it established a permanent war ethos, or at least a permanent war economy in Ottawa. And despite the differences expressed by people like Pearson and Trudeau and even Chrétien in 2003, Canada has been lockstep in this permanent war economy for the last more than half a century, right?
Yeah, I mean, basically 3 or 4 million Koreans were killed because there was a desire to justify military spending stimulate a downturn in the economy after World War II, and obviously World War II is what ended the Great Depression and all the public and military spending. And so after World War II, in Washington and in Ottawa, there was concern about economic downturn, and there was a need to justify ramping up military spending, and the Korean War provided that justification. right? And so literally, I mean, millions of Koreans were killed. What was essentially a civil war within Korea, which, you know, if you look at what a lot of things the U.S. did to stoke the conflict beforehand, but even if you just, you know, leave that aside, but, you know, what was in, you know, mid-1950 a civil war within Korea got ramped up into this shockingly horrendous conflict where at one point the U.S. stopped bombing North Korea because every building of more than two stories had been destroyed. This was justified. This whole conflict was stimulated. I mean, part of it was also that China had Mao's forces had won in 1949, the year before, and so, you know, Korean War was also about sort of containing China, and there was, you know, elements there. But a really important part of it was really just justifying military spending, and part of it is the instability of capitalism, and that's, you know, military Keynesianism is a form of you know, when there's downturns, there's a need to instigate public spending to end what can be and had been in the lead up to the with the Great Depression, a self reinforcing process of economic downturn, that as things start going downwards, if the government or, you know, public entity doesn't step in to stimulate the economy, that capitalists themselves will just keep driving things in a worse economic direction. And so what military Keynesianism does is it something that the is not viewed as threatening, right? It's not like other forms of public spending that tend to reinforce or tend to strengthen, working class power or you know, social entitlements that tend to uplift the most marginalized. Military spending, on the other hand, tends to, first of all, the class structure or the top-down structure of the military is very much viewed positively from the corporate sector. The military, as I've mentioned previously, is you know, very much tied into the corporate structure. But also military spending, it has all these spin-offs, right? First of all, a lot of the spending goes to these arms companies, but also it provides all kinds of technological, high-tech research kind of spin-offs, right? Initial computers in this country come from the military. The military is what sponsored the research into computers. So many high-tech inventions, certainly in the post-World War II period, it's military spending that really stimulated those inventions. So that's a part of the war economy. Now, years after World War II, or specifically after the beginning of the Korean War, the military played an even bigger role, of course, in economic affairs. That has subsided, but there's still example after example where military spending is very much used. One, to stimulate the economy, and two, to corporate welfare, really, but also to generate sort of research, public funding of research that has broader benefits to corporate Canada.
Well, and the whole idea of Canadian forces incorporated, with generals becoming CEOs or executives of these arms companies, in a revolving door that we've seen in the United States, of course, these last 50 or 80 years. It's been 100 years and more now since the end of the first Great War, the war that was going to end all wars as advertised. I mentioned in the introduction. You're going to be coming out here, Eve, to Victoria and environs on your book tour. And again, if you've just tuned in, I'm speaking with Eve Engler about his new book, Stand on Guard, for Whom? A People's History of the Canadian Military. Your book tour is going to take you to Nanaimo, Victoria, Duncan, and Vancouver from the 10th. I'm just looking at it here. You're going to be in Nanaimo on the 10th of November, then down in Victoria on the 11th. this idea of the corporatized military. Of course, corporations can't exist without a good PR office. We've talked in the past about the alacrity of Canada's the Canadian military's PR infrastructure. I think Canadians would be really surprised to realize just how large that infrastructure is.
Well, the military has the largest public relations apparatus in the country. It also has the largest intelligence apparatus in the country. In terms of the public relations apparatus, I mean, there's hundreds and hundreds. There is no definitive number, but some articles have suggested over 600 public relations officials within the Canadian military. There's a list of 50 different communications offices that the Canadian military has across the country. So we're talking about people who would, write press releases, have, relationships to local media, who would respond if something happens, maybe comment to the media if something happens. And that's, this huge apparatus. No other institution in the country has, that many public relations officials. But then it goes way beyond that, where they have their own history department with something like 50 employees. So it would probably be on the size of a major university's history department. All 50 employees are not all historians. I think it's something like two dozen. But probably the size of, I don't know what Concordia University's history, but probably something about the size of like a Concordia University's history department. Then they have funding for academic departments. They provide a bunch of the security department, security studies programs across the country. They were basically established with military funding, and they continue to receive military funding. Then you have Veterans Affairs, which is it's a whole own department. So when we talk about the military budget, which is something around $24 billion now, that doesn't include Veterans Affairs, which has another about $5 billion in spending, and I believe it's something like 4,000 more employees. And Veterans Affairs is involved in funding, and as we come towards Remembrance Day, Veterans Affairs funds dozens, hundreds of Remembrance Day events across the country. They also, throughout the year, they're funding initiatives between, with like the CFL, the football games. And if you look at what the publications, they fund all kinds of books and whatnot. If you look at the publications, if you look at how they describe, World War One, or how they describe the Korean War, it's really heavy on defending our freedoms and democracy, even when, World War One or the Korean War, we're not about defending freedoms or democracy. I mean, that's just preposterous. It's a ridiculous effort, explanation of what happened during World War One or the Korean War. But that is, it's commonly held, and it's in part because the military has such a massive public relations apparatus, and they are constantly pumping out new books, articles, websites, press releases, etc., that are portraying the military in a positive light, portraying their perspective on global affairs, and so it has a big impact on our understanding. And unfortunately, there's not many media outlets that are willing to really challenge that perspective, and so. The military is this, huge ideological. It has, huge economic element to it, but it also has this huge ideological influence that pervades pretty much all elements of Canadian political life. And it's the rare media outlets that are willing to directly challenge that influence.
Well, and far from challenging, they support. If you look at the CBC or CTV, the big media papers and so forth in this country, they're all four square behind the Canadian military and militarism, none daring to challenge some of the things that you bring up in your books. Again, Eve's latest book is Stand on Guard for Whom, A People's History of the Canadian Military. Eve will be in Nanaimo November 10th at the Vancouver Island Regional Library. Here in Victoria, November 11th at our Victoria Public Library downtown in the courtyard. We're in Duncan at the United Church on the 12th, is that, Eve? Sorry, I'm...
Yeah, 12th at noon.
11th, 12th at Duncan, and the 14th over in Vancouver at the United... at Spartacus Books, rather. There you go. United Church in Duncan, Spartacus Books on the 14th. Eve, congratulations again on your latest book, Stand on Guard for Whom, and all your long history of work on this, doing the things that not only the media but other academics in this country are failing to pick up on, and recording the most important element of our history and how it affects the way we live and operate in the world now. Eve, thanks again for coming on. I want the rest of you to stick around because you know there's great programming coming up. That's all I have for this week. Until the next time, thanks again, Eve.
Thank you.
To explore the power of plant-based living, from the barnyards to the courtrooms and everywhere in between. Listen to Plant Powered Radio every Tuesday, 11 till noon, on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria.
I'm Kajal, and I work at the UVSS Food Bank and Free Store. We are excited to announce that we are back up and running in the food bank, located in the basement of the sub, room B005. All undergraduate students at UVic are able to access the food bank once every week. All you have to do is sign up in advance online at uvss.ca/foodbank.